Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economist Yanis Varoufakis on the Cyprus mess. And then we'll talk with Jonathan Weston, director of Fast Food Forward, about the movement to unionize fast food workers in New York City, a movement that should spread across the country. Meeting earlier this week, the Federal Reserve voted to keep its policy of quantitative easing, or QE, meaning buying lots of treasury and mortgage bonds in an effort to keep down long-term interest rates, and voted to keep that going, despite criticism from right-wing inflation hawks. QE also gets criticism from the left because it's seen as a gift to the financial markets, though criticisms from the left don't enter into the Fed's normal deliberations. There is a point to that critique. And there are other things that the Fed could do to stimulate the economy more directly, like funding state and local government infrastructure investment, for one. But for that to happen would require a very different political environment from the crabbed one we live in. The right-wing idea that QE is stoking inflationary fires is dangerous and insane in an economy as sick as this one. The right would like the Fed to drop all concern with unemployment and focus just on price stability. My main problem with QE, short of the more utopian infrastructure critique, is that it's probably not very effective. But Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is one of the few public figures who speaks openly and often about the plight of the unemployed, and for all his limitations, he's trying to do something about it. Bernanke's term as chair is up early next year, and look for a serious effort from the right to find a more austere successor. A contrast between Bernanke's efforts at stimulus and the ham-handed austerity prevailing in the Eurozone is remarkable. The latest episode is Cyprus, a very small country with an oversized banking system, stuffed with offshore money that's now in the middle of a dramatic collapse. The Euro authorities insisted that Cyprus, tiny and broke, had to fund part of its own bailout, and the government of Cyprus decided to tax bank deposits to do it, small ones as well as big ones, a cruel and dangerous idea. The Cypriot parliament rejected it, so now it's back to the drawing board. Here's Yanis Varoufakis, who had to leave his institutional home at the University of Athens for a visiting professorship at the University of Texas because his university is broke, to talk about the situation. We caught up with him in Sydney, which is why this interview opens with a discussion of the Australian economy. Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. So you're in Australia. I thought Australia was one of the few places in the world not suffering from an economic crisis.
It is one of those places where the economic crisis is not utterly evident, especially on the streets as you're walking around. But in this day and age, after 2008, wherever you happen to be on the planet, if you scratch the surface and you have a keen eye and ear, you will find evidence of a very bad crisis everywhere you look.
Australia had been benefiting from the commodities boom and particularly Chinese demand. Is that ebbing? What's happening?
Oh, this is still what is going on. They're effectively chopping up the country in small pieces and transporting it to China. Outside Sydney port, the harbour of Sydney, there is a line of about 50 nautical miles of container ships waiting to be loaded with coal, with iron ore, with bauxite, with all sorts of different minerals to be transported to China. But interestingly, this is creating, within the context of the global crisis, incredible tensions and ruptures within the social economy of Australia. So if you happen to be one of those Australians lucky enough to be connected directly to this booming sector, mining sector, then, you know, your incomes are increasing exponentially. But if you happen to be a teacher, or if you happen to be in some of the industries that are not directly linked to the mining boom, then you are surrounded by an inflationary process which effectively prices you out of the housing market, out of the restaurant market, out even of the supermarkets. So you have increasing divisions, You have expanding and enhanced inequities, and you have a society which is becoming increasingly ill at ease with itself, because even those who are connected to the mining boom and whose incomes are increasing fast, they're feeling the pinch of negative expectations about what's going to happen when commodity prices, as is their wont, start sliding, when China goes into reverse, and when the bubbles in which they live are going to blow.
Yeah, I was going to say, this sounds like the sort of thing that doesn't end well.
Indeed, and people here in Australia feel that. They may be going out to fancy restaurants and be driving Mercedes Benzes, but you can tell by the look on their faces that deep down they are utterly cognizant of the fact that they, you know, they are on borrowed time.
What about the rest of? I didn't mean to talk about the Australian economy, but the Australians had been a little cocky a few years ago about how they were insulated from the global crisis. What's going on in the rest of the economy? Do they have any manufacturing? What is the base of Australia? Is it just mining and associated bubble-related industries now?
Australia has made a significant effort to arrest the decline in its industry and to develop some high-tech industries with some success. Australian science and engineering has been quite successful in developing a number of important technologies like bionic ears, like, you know, I don't know whether you know that, but Wi-Fi was discovered in this country. The problem, however, is that the mining boom has caused the Australian dollar to skyrocket, to be consistently above the US dollar in value. And this is affecting manufacturing and industry in this country very adversely. The government is trying to make amends to ameliorate the situation through subsidies. So the car industry here is receiving enormous subsidies in order to keep going. It's, you know, effectively the Australian taxpayer has to bribe Toyota and Ford and General Motors to keep producing cars in this country. But this is not a sustainable and viable dynamic, and everybody knows this.
Okay, moving on to the crisis of the month, Cyprus. Who knew? The rest of the world, I don't think, gives much thought to Cyprus, and here it is all over the front pages now. What is the genesis of this crisis?
The best way of thinking about Cyprus is to think of it as the island of the Eastern Mediterranean. The parallel between Ireland and Cyprus is very useful, and let me just try to explain that. Unlike Greece, for instance, Cyprus did not have a sovereign debt problem. The budget deficit was always kept under control. There was no corruption, no tax evasion. Indeed, the Cypriot state was a model state. It was functioned just as well as the Irish state was prior to 2007-2008. What has blown up in Cyprus, just like in Ireland, is, of course, its banking sector and the related real estate sector. Now, the difference between the two is that the Irish boom in the real estate sector and, of course, in the financial sector was caused by a tsunami of capital that had flowed into Ireland from Germany in particular. In Cyprus, the tsunami of capital that caused that those bubbles came from Russia. A lot of oil rubles were converted into euros and safely, or that's what they thought, deposited in Cypriot banks. We had a situation where about eight times Cyprus's GDP was deposited into the small economies' banks. And that money was then lent on by the Cypriot banks to all sorts of projects, mainly to do with real estate, that created a bubble in real estate. And of course, you know, when the bubble burst, as these bubbles do burst during a great financial crisis, especially one in the Eurozone, which is quite universal within the Eurozone, then, you know, a negative feedback effect begins. The developers go bust once the house prices go down and they can't recoup the cost of having built them. Then the banks have bad loans that are not being serviced anymore by the bankrupt developers. And as building sites become abandoned and workers lose their jobs, the state suddenly sees its revenues decline. unemployment increases, unemployment benefit costs rise, so you have the wholesale collapse of the state and the banks. This is pretty much what happened in Ireland.
Did the Cypriot banks also have money in Greek sovereign bonds?
Indeed, indeed. And they took a hit on that last year in February, March 2012 with a Greek haircut. Something in the order between 3 and 4 billion was shaved off, and that shook them. But it's not the real cause. Even without that, the Cypriot economy would have entered the tailspin for precisely the reasons why Ireland did.
There's a saying on Wall Street that the growth in a credit aggregate, rapid growth in a credit aggregate, should be a leading indicator of crisis. This has certainly been proved time and time again. But nobody paid attention, as nobody in the outside world seemed to pay much attention as Cyprus was expanding. How did this happen with no one noticing?
Well, I mean, this is the story of our lives over the last 20 years. All sorts of awful things that with hindsight, you know, the world should have paid attention to, went unnoticed. When Wall Street indulged in the massive minting of toxic money during the 90s and noughties, no one noticed then. So imagine how easy it was for, you know, the public's attention, not to see what was going on in Cyprus. I mean, a lot of people did see it, but the dominant paradigm of the time was we live in a new era, in an era where the old fear of risk should be set aside, because now we have the financial instruments which allow us to spread the risk around and ensure that it's not systemically threatening. Of course, all this was rubbish.
So, but the austerity hounds at the European Central Bank didn't notice either.
Well, did they notice what happened in Spain? Did they notice what happened in Ireland? Did they notice what was going on in Greece? Did they indeed notice what was going on in the Frankfurt private banks, which were, you know, when the Lehman Brothers debacle happened, the Germans and the French were congratulating themselves for, you know, having defeated Anglo-Saxon capitalism, thinking that their own banking system was more prudent than Wall Street and the City of London. And then when a few days later they looked inside those banks, they found that they had leverage ratios much, much greater than those of Lehman Brothers.
But they're very good at administering punishment once the blow-up happens.
Look at what happened last weekend. Last weekend, I think that the Eurogroup, the group of European finance ministers belonging to the Eurozone, effectively it was as if they declared to the world that they are just utterly incapable of managing a manageable crisis. It was like, you know, a statement to the world that they can't escape out of a brown paper bag.
I'm speaking with the economist, Yanis Varoufakis. Yeah, let's talk about this. This seems like one of the worst episodes of economic policymaking in modern times, the deposit tax. Where'd that come from? Who's responsible for that insane proposal?
Well, it's a collective effort on behalf of our great and good European Eurozone financial ministers. I mean, they just, you know, they're just as bad as one another. It is a genuine collective effort. It's, you know, it's just like a camel is designed by a committee. So was this monstrosity. But look, where the history of it is quite simple, really. Let me remind you that the problem that we have in the Eurozone is we have insolvent states and insolvent banks hanging on to one another and sinking very rapidly to the bottom. And back in June, actually, June 2012, the European Union decided quite correctly to try to stop this sort of death embrace between insolvent states and insolvent banks by having the banks being recapitalized directly from the bailout fund, the ESM, as it is called now. Germany, within a few days, reneged on that agreement. And what we are having now in Cyprus, as well as what we're having in Spain and what we're having in Italy, is the result of that refusal by Germany to honor that agreement. Effectively, what Germany is saying, and they are saying it explicitly through Mr. Schäuble, the finance minister of the federal government in Berlin, they're saying that we are refusing steadfastly to accept that this is a systemic crisis. We insist that this is You know, the Cypriot crisis is a crisis to be sorted out by the Cypriots. The Irish crisis must be sorted out by the Irish, the Spanish by the Spanish, and so on and so forth. It is not a Eurozone crisis. The Eurozone is going to lend money, but you're going to have to pay for it. Now, of course, that can't happen, because when you have an insolvent banking sector coupled with an insolvent state, there's no power in the universe that can help this pair of insolvents to actually pull themselves up from the bootstraps, as Germany is insisting. So once Cyprus imploded last week, actually for the last few months, but now, you know, they reached the point where they couldn't delay a decision on Cyprus anymore, they came to one rational conclusion, which unfortunately push them into the wrong track. The rational conclusion they came to was they can't do with Cyprus what they did with Greece. So in the case of Greece, if you remember, in May 2010, they decided to lend to Greece a huge amount of money so that the Greek taxpayer would try using that huge loan, the largest loan in human history, to pay off all the debts of the banks and the state. They realized, thankfully, that this is just utterly impossible. They can't do that, just like Greece collapsed and then had to have a haircut and another haircut, and just to enter this tailspin in which it finds itself, they shouldn't try to do this in Cyprus. So they decided very correctly that there has to be some kind of restructuring, some haircut, something had to be cut before a new loan is given to Cyprus. And they decided that since a great deal of money is being so sort of owed to, there are a lot of banking losses. There are a lot of deposits in Cyprus banks that effectively the Cypriot taxpayer will have to shoulder by borrowing money, that instead of pushing all that burden on the Cypriot taxpayer, some of that burden must be shared with the depositors in Cypriot banks. Now, that is not irrational. I think that this is I'm pretty much in support of that. The tragedy, however, is that when they did the maths, they found out that if they're going to stick to the commitment of the Cypriot state, and indeed every member state of the Eurozone, not to touch deposits up to 100,000, like in the United States, where the FDIC guarantees a certain amount within every bank account. Similarly, in the Eurozone, each member state guarantees up to 100,000 euros in each bank account. Now, if they were going to respect that, they would have to haircut the bank accounts containing more than 100,000 to the tune of 15 to 16%. And the Cypriot government balked at this idea because it would upset the Russian depositors too much. So the Cypriot president effectively drew the line at 10%. So they made it 9.9%. And they said, well, that's the maximum that we're going to haircut deposit accounts by. To do that and to be able to achieve a haircut that would make the whole loan agreement that the taxpayers would shoulder palatable, the algebra showed that even small accounts containing 1,000 euros, 2,000 euros, 10,000 euros, must also be haircut by almost 7%. So effectively, that's how they all around the table, the Eurozone finance ministers, came to this conclusion. They signed on the dotted line without realizing that effectively what they were doing was that they were putting their signature on an agreement that would have a member state of the Eurozone default on its commitment to depositors to guarantee their deposits up to 100,000 euros. Now, if you had some money in a Spanish bank account and, you know, it was 20,000, 30,000 euros, Would you keep it there once you heard that this is what happened in Cyprus? I bet you wouldn't. You would transfer it to a bank account in Germany. So effectively, our great and good European finance ministers created the circumstances for a massive deterioration of the Eurozone crisis and an escalation of capital flight from the periphery to the center, which is precisely what the European Central Bank and our European leaders were supposedly trying to avert over the last year.
This just seems so obvious. This is a lesson we learned in the 1930s, that deposit insurance is very, very important to keep banking systems afloat. In the midst of a crisis, to violate that law, you have to ask, what were they thinking? I mean, can they really be that stupid?
It obviously the answer to your question is yes, they can, and because they did it. And now, as we speak, they are having one meeting, one teleconference after the other, trying to make amends, trying to change, to reverse that decision, 3, 4, 5 days after the event. They don't have any new information. So why are they revisiting the decision that they reached last Saturday? Simply because the decision last Saturday, now they realize, was completely and utterly idiotic. And the question is, why did they feel on Saturday that it was not idiotic? And I think that what has been happening over the last 3 years is that there has been this overarching and overwhelming commitment by European finance ministers, presidents, and prime ministers to deny that this is a systemic crisis. In this context, they've been trying to find any other alternative which will not admit to the systematicity, to the systematic nature of this crisis. So if you look at all the decisions they've been making for the last year, 3 years, each one of them has been utterly illogical. The calmness in the bond markets over the last 8-9 months, which was achieved by the European Central Bank intervening and making that great statement, you remember Mr. Draghi in July saying that he will do whatever it takes to save the euro, that calmed the bond markets. Unfortunately, the calm in the bond markets that the ECB president managed to establish on behalf of Europe's politicians and to give them the opportunity to find a solution to the Eurozone crisis, a lasting, systematic solution to the systemic crisis in the Eurozone, instead of using that calmness and that time that the ECB bought them, what happened in the end was that during that time, they grew more complacent, they became more careless, and they reached the apotheosis of collective stupidity, thinking that they could get away with this by having, their cake and eat it, to have no separation of the banking crisis from the debt crisis, A. B, to have a reduction in the amount of loans that the surplus countries would have to give to Cyprus, and at the same time, not to put off too badly the Russian oligarchs who have their money, foolishly, as it turns out, in Cypriot banks. But of course, you can't have your cake and eat it. In an attempt to have their cake and to eat it, what they did was they violated one of the basic principles that, as you said, we've known since 1932, that you need a deposit insurance scheme that people can trust, and that trust should never be violated, because if it is, then you have a bank run in your hands and you have a monetary union which is going from bad to worse.
I'm speaking with the economist Yanis Varoufakis. Yes, I read this aphorism the other day that it makes no sense to start a bank run, but once one is underway, it makes no sense not to participate.
That's right. I think Ben Bernanke said that, didn't he?
Well, I was just going to say, hearing these things almost makes me give thanks for having Ben Bernanke running the Fed.
Well, you only have to compare and contrast the statements that come from Ben Bernanke with the statements that come from Germany and the ECB. However much one dislikes, and as a left-winger, Ben Bernanke is not my pin-up boy, but nevertheless, in the present context, he looks like something in between Che Guevara, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, Friedrich von Hayek, and Einstein. I very much like what he said the other day, tongue-in-cheek, and I'm sure he was referring to Germany and to the ECB, that he's not into the Old Testament theory of business cycles.
Well, he's also responding to some Republican right-wing criticism of him as well, I think. Rick Perry, yes, I think.
Yes, indeed. Yes. But I think that he was also referring, I mean, what is the Old Testament theory of banking? That, you know, that you have to come down like a ton of bricks on those in deficit and those who are finding it impossible to repay their debts through austerity, and just completely kill off any chances they have of generating the income from which to repay their debts.
Of course, there's the other side of the Old Testament, which is the debt jubilee, but we're not about to have one of those.
Unfortunately not, unless, of course, you are a Wall Street banker, in which case you have a debt jubilee all the time.
I've asked you this question many times, and I'm going to ask it again, some version of it again. You know, you look at all this, and you wonder, what in God's name are these people thinking? Now, you said earlier they're not seeing this as a systemic crisis, but just some sort of, you know, little isolated liquidity crisis here and there. But what is driving German thinking? Is this German domestic politics that's really driving their thinking, or is there some kind of interest among the German elite in pushing the rest of the continent to the wall like this?
I think it's a combination of three things. Firstly, there is a German government now that is facing a difficult federal election in September. It's not going to be a walk in the park, as many commentators have said. And they don't want any major change in the course followed by the Eurozone. They went through a major crisis, existentialist crisis, the German elite, the German government, during the summer months, to decide what to do with Greece. They came out of it with a firm decision to keep it in the Eurozone and to support, even while waterboarding the Greek social economy, but to support it sufficiently to keep it in the Eurozone. And they effectively decided that between now, or last September, and next September, they want a steady-as-she-goes attitude, and they want no major decisions. If there was a pause button, they would simply press it, hoping that, you know, the September federal election would come, and no, you know, they wouldn't give any kind of opportunity to the SPD, the social democratic opposition, to take a shot at them. That's one. There are another two reasons. The second reason is, I believe that there is a very strong movement within the financial sector of Frankfurt and some other political and economic forces in Germany for returning to the Deutschmark, or for not minding too much if at some point Germany returns to the Deutschmark. You see that in the statements by Mr. Weidmann, the chairman of the Bundesbank, the president of the Bundesbank. He's not a stupid man. But if you take for granted his statements about what should or shouldn't happen at the level of the European Central Bank in the Eurozone and so on and so forth, the only logical conclusion or interpretation of what he has to say is that he's become the de facto leader of the faction within the German elites that would very much like to go back to the Deutschmark. And the third reason, and that concerns Mrs. Merkel in particular and politicians like Mrs. Merkel, who do not want to go to the Deutschmark, they have not been convinced of that, is that even though they do not want to go to the Deutschmark, they feel that they should never make any concessions to the rest of the Eurozone that stop Germany from going to the Deutschmark if it so chooses at some future date. So let me put it very briefly, Doug. The things that we can do to resolve the Eurozone crisis today without having the Germans pay 1 euro more in order to achieve this resolution. Indeed, they would pay less. The cost of the crisis would be lesser if we did what we had to do in order to resolve this crisis. Nevertheless, if we were to do the things that we had to do, Germany would never be able to exit the Eurozone ever, because you would have a degree of debt mutualization. You would have a banking union which would stop, you know, the separation of the German banking sector from the French, from the Greek, from the Italian. And therefore, you know, once you have this degree of unification, then it is impossible, just like it is impossible for California or New York State to get out of the dollar zone. And Mrs. Merkel, while she does not want to get out of the Eurozone, understands, because she is a very good politician, she understands that these days, when she opens her mouth in at the European Union level, in a council meeting, the French president, the French president might be, Mr. Hollande, Mr. Sarkozy, doesn't matter who it is, will shut up simply because he fears that Germany will leave the Eurozone, whereas France, being a deficit country, can never leave the Eurozone. So she's not going to make any of those moves, like, for instance, direct recapitalization of the Cypriot or the Irish or the Greek banks, that will constrain Germany's right and opportunity to get out of the Eurozone and back to the Deutschmark, for the simple reason that she knows, that everybody in Europe knows, that if Germany no longer has the opportunity to get out of the Eurozone, then the bargaining power of the German Chancellor in the European Union Council is diminished, and this is something she's not prepared to see done.
What would the interest in Germany be in leaving the Eurozone? You know, we spoke, last year maybe, you said that they liked the euro because it removed the option of devaluation from their weaker competitors. And so this is to the benefit of German industry. But what would the advantages be of leaving the Eurozone for Germany?
Well, the main advantage would be that they wouldn't have to worry about bailing out anybody else. And this is, not to be scoffed at. They wouldn't have to go into these long debates with the Greeks and the Irish and the Spanish about how much money will go into the Irish and the Greek banks and so on and so forth. But of course, and look, there is another great benefit for Germany if they do get out of the Eurozone. And that is that there's going to be massive, massive capital flight from the rest of Europe, indeed from the rest of the world, into the Frankfurt banks in anticipation of the revaluation of the German currency. Now, I'm not saying that that the German government, that Mr. Schäuble and Mrs. Merkel, wants to get out of the Eurozone. What I'm saying is that they do not want to lose their option of getting out of the Eurozone, because having that option, even if they don't want to use it, is giving them an exorbitant amount of political power within the European Union.
And I know I'm keeping you up very late, and I'm very grateful for you to staying up so late to do this, but just a few words about Greece. Any news there? Is it still an ongoing crisis?
Oh, it's getting far, far worse, Doug. We have reached now a stage where there isn't even a debate in Greece, a serious debate about recovery. Even the government, which was promising recovery by the end of 2013, now has taken this back. We now have a situation where the social economy is broken. And the last hope for the government was the recapitalization of the banks sometime now in March or April, to the tune of 40 billion euros. Money that the bankrupt Greek state, hear this and weep, the bankrupt Greek state is borrowing 40 billion euros from the bailout fund, the EFSF, in order to plug the holes in the Greek banks. But, with all this discussion now about Cyprus and so on and so forth, the capital flight, whatever capital is left in these banks, is simply flying very fast and furiously towards Geneva, towards Frankfurt, towards London, towards the United States. And there is no chance in hell, excuse my language, that this recapitalization is going to do anything. It's like throwing, it's just pouring a cup of water into a dry well and hoping that well is going to be used for irrigation purposes. It's not going to succeed. And we have a situation now where the credit circuits are totally defunct, and even profitable firms have no access to the credit mechanism in Greece. So Greece is a lost cause at the moment, and it will remain lost. And in this tailspin, I call it the conversion of Greece into a Mediterranean Kosovo, a protectorate that lacks any kind of sovereignty, any kind of legitimate governance, and any prospect of growing and becoming, a functioning social economy, as long as the Eurozone crisis continues, because the Eurozone is denying that there is a systemic crisis within the Eurozone.
And the political beneficiaries from the crisis in Greece, is Golden Dawn still on the rise?
Yes, absolutely. The Nazis are having a revival in one of the few countries that during the 1940s was exceptionally successful in creating a partisan army which had the support of 98% of the population to rout out the Nazis. This is not history repeating itself as fast. This is history repeating itself as a very bitter tragedy.
That was Yiannis Varoufakis, professor of economics at the University of Athens, who's got a visiting gig in Austin, Texas this year. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Was some of Schubert's impromptu D-899 No. 3, performed by Alfred Brendel. Next up, Jonathan Weston, director of Fast Food Forward, an effort to organize fast food workers in New York City. This is a local story. It's of national interest, since there's no reason why fast food workers across the U.S. shouldn't get unionized. Jonathan Weston.
Welcome. Okay, could you start by just giving us a little background on the fast food campaign, where it came from?
Yeah. So, at New York Communities for Change, we've been organizing low-wage workers in different industries around New York City. Started organizing within supermarkets and within car washes, where we were organizing workers calling for better pay and better working conditions. Now, really coming at it from a community angle, being a community organization, the biggest issue we realized facing low-income families in neighborhoods across New York City are the general lack of decent paying work. And within that, we started talking to fast food workers within the fast food industry, being one of the biggest employers of low-income families throughout the city, and started talking to workers about the conditions within the restaurants that they worked in. And unanimously, people were making minimum wage or close to minimum wage, only getting part-time hours. So even at the minimum wages they were being paid were making very meager incomes based off of the wages and the hours that they were getting in the restaurants. And there were a lot of different issues within the workplaces around scheduling, around people getting burned, around not having days to take off to care for their sick family members, or if by any reasonable stretch wanting to even take a vacation or things like that. Workers just weren't able to do, and workers were living in poverty all throughout the industry while people were working, not even being able to afford the hamburgers they were serving themselves. And what we found was folks that couldn't afford to, even put food on the table for their family, even afford the train ride to work sometimes. Some workers were walking from Bushwick in Brooklyn over the bridge into Manhattan to go work in Harlem because they couldn't afford the train ride to work. And these were the conditions people were living and working in. And, the campaign began around workers wanting a different state of life that they weren't getting being employed in McDonald's and Burger King and Taco Bell and Pizza Hut and all these other fast food chains.
Now, you mentioned putting food on the table for the family. The cliche is that a lot of these workers are just kids picking up extra money. Clearly, that's not true. What does the workforce look like?
Yeah, the workforce is, the median age is mid to upper 20s. Most of the folks that are working in these places are raising families themselves or trying to put themselves through college or just trying to get by. And it's not teenagers working after school jobs as many folks would be led to believe. I mean, the jobs that people are falling into, especially after the recession, are low-wage service jobs, like the jobs in the fast food industry. And these are families and, you know, people with children, even grandmothers, and folks like that, and not your after-school job teenagers.
You said that they're not even able to afford the combination Big Mac that they're serving other people. This is not notoriously expensive food, so really the earnings are very low.
The earnings are very low, and like I was saying, making $7.25 an hour, which is the minimum wage, or close to $7.25 an hour, even people being there for years, there are people been there for 10 years that are still making hardly $8 an hour. At that, they're also not getting hours. People are being employed in the fast food industry are getting 15, 20 hours a week, which is not sustainable. And most workers want more hours. Most workers want to do more work. They're just not given the ability by the restaurants to actually be full-time employees and bring home a pay that they can raise their families on.
Now, another cliche about the business in the past seems to have made it hard to organize is that there's extremely high turnover, that people don't stay in these jobs very long. Is that true?
No, that's not true. People are at these restaurants for years. There's people that have worked in these restaurants for decades. Most of the workers we're organizing have been at the restaurant over 2 years. The argument that there's high turnover is just actually false.
How do you go about organizing people like this? I mean, it seems like a major challenge. So what's your strategy?
Yeah, I think, one of the main reasons it's been a challenge is because people have had this view that it is teenagers. But when we actually started having conversations with folks, like I said, these are families and people just struggling to get by. And through having these conversations, people wanted to organize and people wanted to get involved, calling and demanding from the fast food industry, these multi-billion-dollar corporations that are actually back in the black and making profits after the recession while many of the workers are still struggling to get by and pay rent. And that people really saw the disparity between the billions in profits and the millions the CEOs make and what they're making serving burgers every day, that it just didn't add up. So it was this momentum that led to the organizing and workers forming committees and coming together to call for changes throughout the entire industry.
Unlike many organizing campaigns, you're trying to do this at many sites across many employers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the differences in this organizing campaign, especially, because we're coming at it from a community level, is how is this actually affecting low-income communities and families that are working poor throughout the city? Is that it's not just any one fast food employer, it's the entire industry that treats folks the same way, that keeps them working for poverty wages and keeps the families there in poverty themselves. So taking on an industry-wide campaign and organizing people at different levels to call for a change within the industry.
You can't use a classic strike tactic, can you?
What would a classic strike tactic be? Because one of the things that we have used as our tactic has been workers going out on strike, not through the traditional organizing processes, but actually showing, really based off of what Walmart workers have done all over the country, where they showed that you can go out on strike and protest for better wages and better working conditions and confront your bosses and send a message loud and clear that they don't want to be treated this way, and that, they've been able to use these tactics to really elevate their issues.
But these are short-term strikes, not things that are meant to go on for weeks.
Yeah, workers started, and the difference between many organizing campaigns is the first action that workers took was actually to go out on strike, to go out for a day and protest the conditions that they are working in, and it was just the start of the campaign, which is one of the differences in the organizing tactics that's happening with workers, is that they can do these things and not have to just be behind the scenes all the time, to actually confront their employers face to face and say, we are organizing and we are building a movement so that we can improve the conditions within our industry.
Are workers facing any retaliation for these actions?
We had 200 workers go out on strike in November. Every one of the workers that went out on strike got their jobs and nobody was fired. Employers have largely tried to steer clear of retaliating against workers in such a broad-based way And I think a lot of that is because workers took such a public stance. If workers were only organizing behind the scenes, it might empower the employers to retaliate against them even more. And I think that's one of the benefits of how workers organized and went out and did public strikes, so that they could really show that if folks are retaliated against, that there would be, you know, a lot of community disapproval, and a lot of backlash from, you know, the folks in our neighborhoods that understand the workers' fight.
And since this is also not a traditional, like, workplace-centered struggle, what kind of community support are you orchestrating?
So we have actually been working with ministers and clergy who are a huge part of the strikes in November and will be an integral part of the campaign, who understand this. And I think, as we saw in many of the civil rights struggles in the 60s, that the ministers and churches and the communities are really a driving force behind improving conditions in neighborhoods throughout the city and throughout the country. So ministers have been out there in force at a Wendy's, actually, in Brooklyn, where one of the workers was actually retaliating against, and they threatened her job. One of the city councilmen, Jumani Williams, along with community leaders from the Working Families Party, from United New York, and other organizations that came out to support the workers, went in and demanded her job back. And after the manager realized and called corporate that it would be best to just give the worker their job back than actually face the continued community action against these stores. And I think, you know, one of the differences between the typical organizing campaigns, the community is heavily engaged. Elected officials, clergy, community members, civic leaders have been coming out in support of these workers.
And I don't want you to spill any trade secrets, but how are you planning to escalate this struggle?
I think, you know, what we've been doing over the past 4 or 5 months was continuing to build support within stores. The strikes actually have really been a driver for worker interest in organizing. When folks saw their coworkers go out at that same Wendy's I talked about, when the worker was threatened with being fired, and then the workers in the store saw the elected officials, the clergy, and the community rally behind her and get her job back, the workers were even more emboldened and were giving people thumbs up, saying, "This is great, we love what you're doing," and we've been able to use that energy to build more support within stores. So, you know, there will be more actions taken, bigger actions that engage more workers, but really building the worker involvement to, you know, change the whole industry.
And what kind of wage and hour demands are you making?
Workers have been demanding $15 an hour and the rights to form a union. Living in New York City, which is the most expensive city in the country, workers believe a fair demand from some of the richest corporations in this country that are making billions of dollars in profit would be that they could pay their workers a wage of $15 an hour that would allow folks to actually pay their rent, put food on their table, and maybe be able to take a vacation, you know, once in their life.
And this is a national or international radio broadcast. So, what kind of actions are there? Similar actions going on elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, well, in Pennsylvania last week or the week before, guest workers, which are immigrant workers in this country who came here to get an education and to, you know, experience, you know, in the United States, were being employed by a few different McDonald's in Pennsylvania. And those workers took a similar tactic and went out on strike, protesting the fact that in many cases they were being paid $1 an hour. Because the wages that they were earning were actually being taken by the employer to pay the rent he was housing these workers, so it would take that money out to pay himself the rent that he thought he was owed. And workers went out in protest, and the McDonald's broke the franchise agreement with this franchise owner who was treating workers so poorly. So the movement is spreading across the country. There are workers taking action around the country, and the movement is building, and we hope that folks on an international level too, because in the fast food industry, many of the profits they make are also from their restaurants abroad. That this will not only be a campaign in New York City to win living wages, but this will be a campaign nationally and internationally to change the practices that the fast food industry has created, and sets the really the standard for within low-wage service sector work.
And finally, this sounds a lot like, as you mentioned earlier, the actions have been taken against Walmart in recent months. Do you guys have any like formal connections, or are you comparing notes? Any solidarity there?
We definitely take inspiration from what the folks at Walmart did, and I think the workers themselves, when workers went on strike on Black Friday and really created a national fervor and momentum around the fact that you could organize within these very low-wage sectors against these huge, huge corporations, they were inspired to go out and do similar. There's no formal connection, but I think both campaigns, take notes from each other and are looking to build a broader low-wage movement together going forward.
That was Jonathan Weston, director of Fast Food Forward, an effort to organize fast food workers in New York City. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Shoplifting by The Slits. Till next week, bye.
Put the cheddar in me pocket. Put the rest under the jacket. Talk to the cashier, one suspect. And if he does, and if he does. Dorada, 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 Dorada. 10 quid for the lot. We've had.